Section number 76 stands for the Defense of Waterborne Commission. House of Government came to report containing the course of the fire at the Sturgis and of the Sunburner Trail of Ocean Bridge, and to write Parliament with a statement that the work is known so far from this incident.
I say the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with questions number 77 and 78.
Question number 77, the Honourable J. J. Mason.
Mr. Speaker, some of the common concern was united rumors that the fire that started at the Sunburner Trail emanated from a porta cabin which had contained gas bottles stored therein, and instead, did the government supply the name of the company that owned the porta cabin, and whether all the licenses to comply with official legislation were in place prior to the incident?
Question number 78, the Honourable J. J. Nevin.
Given the fire that broke out in the vicinity of the Sunburner Trail at Ocean Village, can the government state whether there has been a visit of the common state to the deputy, or is now a requirement to address the sea state under the Sunburner Trail in order to create a safe channel in case of an emergency, and if so, when is this likely to happen?
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the Gibraltar Fire and Rescue Service has produced a report that related to a fire which occurred at the entrance of the Sunburn Hotel at Ocean Village on the 28th of December 2014 at approximately 1700 hours. A copy of this report has been provided to the government. The report will be summarized as follows. The structure where the fire occurred is approximately 12 meters long by 5 meters wide and 4 meters high. It is not a porta cabin, but a service access, although the dimensions are similar to some porta cabins seen around Gibraltar. This was divided into two levels, the lower of 1 meter in height approximately, and the other of 3 meters. Most of the units have been destroyed by the fire, leaving only part of the lower exposed unit. The upper level has been mostly affected by the fire on the western end, and is increasing towards the eastern end. There was a hole on the floor approximately 5 meters from the western entrance. The fire had spread from the lower level to the upper level via this hole. This was later confirmed by CCTV cameras from inside the unit and the Sunburn Hotel. It had then spread upwards and devastated most of the roof and the walls of the upper level. There was also extensive damage to the facade of the Admiral Casino in the Leisure Island Visitor Center. The predominant wind that evening was a strong westerly, and the fire had spread from this direction and been accelerated due to this. In conclusion, there are two options. In the opinion of the Gibraltar Fire and Rescue Service, that the fire seems to have been accidental by a person or persons. The source of ignition would have been a major spray, possibly a cigarette, as it is an area used for smoking, but it found its way under the unit. The strong winds funneled by the corridor between the ship and the casino building lead to the rapid spread of the fire. We, that is the Gibraltar Fire Rescue Service, cannot describe the possibility of an electrical fire, but this is less likely. The Gibraltar Fire Rescue Service has confirmed that there were no butane gas cylinders inside the above-mentioned structure.
Congratulations to the information we on which has been provided. In relation to, I think it's my last question, to question for the 7th year, in relation to the possibility of having to judge underneath the funding for the murder or an emergency for the funding to move away quickly, has that been considered either at the early stages of the coming process or thereafter, I think both of these questions.
You see that the Sunburn is located in Seoul, it looks like a piece of it, but it doesn't have anything. And it's attached to the marina by two very strong arms, so there's a floating structure, but it's not designed to sail like a piece of it. Therefore, the idea that it may need to have a channel which allows it to sail in or out is most relevant in the context of understanding
about the bigger pieces, about this vessel or structure. It really is like a building. So in the same way as the casino would not have been able to sail away if there had been, or as a result of the fire in the same to deal with it, the tumble is not designed in that way either. And I think that's why the answer is structured not to respond to that particular part of the country.
Question number 79, the Honourable Dean Davis and me.
Chinese Chief Minister provides details of the economic study which is based on the local political edition of Fifth Plan in 2015, was being conducted in conjunction with the GFSB and the Chamber of Commerce.
Answer the Honourable Chief
Minister. The economic study referred to is underway, and the study that I was referring to is the one reflecting a number of occasions inside and outside the town about the potential effects of the Baltic Security, the common customs area of the European Union, as well as the excise areas of the Union. A team of economists in the United Kingdom with the appropriate expertise for such a study has been established by the government and the Chamber working together. Members of the team have come to Gibraltar to identify the issues and in particular the economic data that they required in order to carry out the study. This has already been forwarded to them by Her Majesty's Government of Walter, and further data has been collated with a view to a further meeting with them so shortly. That will lead the government, the Chamber, and the Federation to likely put together a questionnaire for businesses in the city, as I've previously also stated in this matter.
I'm grateful for the very complete reply.
Is he able to tell me who the economists are? Is that information that you've been willing to divulge across the course of life?
I believe I have the information. I don't know whether it's appropriate to divulge it across the floor or not without asking, but I'm quite happy to give him the information when we reach us for a moment so he knows who we're dealing with. These are economists from Oxford, and they have been identified by the Chamber, by individuals in the Chamber and individuals in the government's EUID department as having the right sort of expertise. Because I haven't checked whether their names, whether that happens for their names to be made public, I don't feel comfortable making them public today. I'm quite happy to give them to him today, and whilst I go back and check whether they have any difficulty in their names being made public, I'm quite happy in the future in exchange with references to mention them. I know that I'm not sure why they might not want to be referred to in public. They will be instructed to the government and these are the things that people like to boast about, but I haven't quite checked, and therefore I give him the names and I'm later we can determine whether publicity is appropriate.
But, thanks for that as well. And Stephen, in what the understanding of the reply, the purpose of the report The purpose of the report is to inform the type of questions which are then going to be issued to the relevant parties in the role set. But is that report going to be shared with the community or comment once ready? And if so, how is he give a validation to the fact that how he intends to see that report once it's finalized? I don't know whether he's going to publish it or he's taking it out. Is it something we should be willing to share with the opposition? basically, I'd like some information as to how you intend to speak to the folks once it's been available to them. So, let's talk about what it is that we're doing here and what I've said before. In the event that the United Kingdom was to choose to have a referendum on potential exit from the EU, and therefore potentially in the event of that referendum resulting in the United Kingdom negotiating an exit from the EU, Gibraltar needs to understand what its position should be in a negotiation. And that I don't think is an issue which is simply for the purview of the government. But that's why I think it's important that we do it with the Chamber and we do it with the Federation itself, the relevant business organisations. And indeed, to get a point, I'm not even asked whether I would share the information with the opposition. So this information the opposition should have in order to formulate policy, which I hope will likely be the same policy that whoever may be in government at the time may be dealing with. They're probably dealing with issues that will visit that in 2018 and 2019 or thereafter. Because my prediction would be that in the event of there being
a referendum decision that the UK wants to enter the EU, the communications are not simply in or out. It's EEA status or non-EEA status to the UK, what does that mean for Gibraltar, etc. So the referendum result, if a referendum were to occur, and if it were to be an exit result in the UK, it's only the beginning of the UK negotiation with the EU. So we need to understand in what context this information then becomes important for the government of Gibraltar. At that stage, that the government of Gibraltar needs to understand what the Chamber of Federation and businesses in Gibraltar need to understand are the realities that could be visited upon us depending on what type of status we were to choose. So we know that we are comfortable and that we are prosperous in the status that we enjoy at the moment. How might that change? Would those changes be changes that we might seek through negotiation, or would they be changes that might be imposed on us as a result of the United Kingdom's negotiations, but that we might have to be ready for however much we might fight against them? Because we might then be fighting against the UK choosing to do a particular thing in terms of trade to Europe, and we might be the only country of 30,000 in the UK holding it out for a different force of status. So we need to understand what the reality of the common customs union regime is today in legal and economic terms, and how the economy will be affected by entry into that mechanism. The only way to do that is to carry out this in-depth economic analysis and then share it with the business community as a collective, i.e. chamber, and federation, and then seek information from individual businesses through questionnaires, also through the chamber and federation, to then be able to produce a report that informs the government, the opposition, and the chamber and the federation. Why not the whole community? Why not simply publish such a report? Well, such a report is likely to be determinative of what negotiations are going to take vis-a-vis the EU and vis-a-vis the UK. And what we don't need is that those who would be doing their best to argue for us to have the worst possible economic scenario in the future to have that data too. And by that, of course, I mean Spain. So this is information that I think the Chamber needs to have, the Federation needs to have, and members of the Parliament should have, but not information that can necessarily be in the public domain and that people should be able to download and then explain have the ability to use the data. And I think you see that there's pretty straightforward, from my own understanding, that the only thing you have to say is the totality of the requirement to consider. And if they really have to report, from what I understand, if they were there looking at all the possible limitations, even to the extent as to what would be the effect of the UK and therefore Gibraltar leaving the EU. So I think that the last convention we have made on local security was in Gibraltar from the last one that I referred to earlier, and it was in the context of his view as to what the economic, the dire economic consequences that leaving the EU would be for Gibraltar. And so is the report, rather than I originally understood again to this that we're only looking at the possibility of what the effect of Gibraltar entry to the customer economy would be. Is it wide range, or is it simply looking at specific discrete issues? It's about looking at that and other issues. In other words, that and other permutations of different types of membership alternatives for Gibraltar within the EU, the EEA. So, for EU, what does for EU mean in terms of excise duty, in terms of VAT, etc.? What does partial EU mean in terms of VAT but not excise, or excise but not VAT? What does CEA mean, which can probably mean both of those or three other scenarios potentially also being relevant to Gibraltar? And I think you can also draw a conclusion, given the numbers that we're going to be given, of what not being in EEA or not being in EU would mean. So I think the data we will have will enable us to share information and see
all of those potential scenarios was supposed to an analysis and process between those potential scenarios, and that's the data I think we need to have. And it's something that we can only get to know by talking to economists of the state that we're talking to, talking to the residential bodies, and then talking to individual businesses and asking them questions, once we have the right questions to put to them, about how particular aspects of those changes would affect those sectors and industries.
So then move to question number 47, the envelope with the iron railings.
Mr. Speaker, I invite the House to recess for 5 minutes before we continue with the discussion, as a discussion with the Minister who's just arriving to work on the matter.
We'll continue with question number 47, the envelope with the iron railings.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister with responsibility for the fire service say that he is still committed to delivering his manifesto commitment to establishing a new fire station during this term of office?
I answer the Honourable Minister for Education and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, the manifesto commitment was to commence work on a new fire station within this term of office and not establishing within this term of office a new fire station as set out in the Honourable Lady's question. The government has already commenced work on a new fire station as it promised to do. The work on the planning for the new fire station has been finalised, and an announcement with full details will be made when the government is in a position to do so, especially within the term of office.
Mr. Speaker, can the Honourable Minister say when the work of the refurbishment or the building will be started?
Well, as I said, we are working on a plan for this matter, which is something that the government has been working on for a while. Work continues, and this is on an advanced stage. And we will definitely make a full announcement as to what is going to happen. And I expect that work will actually commence within the term of office before the election is called.
Another minister has said that it will be within the same. Was there any indication as to where the site is?
Mr. Speaker, we will make an announcement on that as well.
Question number 48, the Honourable Mr. Diamond Rosenberg.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister with responsibility for the fire service say when the new medical priority dispatch system will go live and if it will be within the term of office?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Education and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, we are working on having the new medical priority dispatch system go live within the term of office.
Question number 49, the Honourable Mrs. Alan Rosen.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Education say how many students have applied to the University of Gibraltar for the next academic year 2015-2016?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Education and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, the recruitment of students for the University of Gibraltar has not yet started. This will commence once the University is established, when the Act for students will be given to Parliament of Class.
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Minister said that the university would be open for business up in September the 1st, 2015. And I understand that students are applying now to universities for the September 2015 entry, and this is why I have asked the question. Is there any way that students can start to apply in preparation for the opening in 2015? Or will they be applying, they'll be allowed to apply for later stage and perhaps have a sort of late entry into the courses?
This is not a question of late entry. This is something that has been planned and will be open in September 2015. We are finalising the legislation, which I hope to be in a position to publish very soon. I am intending to be the Ambassador to Thailand when we made a couple of exceptions of note. And once that is established, then the announcement will be made at the Dr. Thai Courses, and students will be invited to apply. There will be some sort of time, but that is what the other lady is concerned about. There will certainly be time between the announcement being made, between the Ambassador to Thailand, the announcement of the certificate courses, enrollment for those courses in Thailand, and the student actually starting in September 2015.
Has there been any revision of the plans for the Djibouti University by the government since the announcement was made in terms of the scope of the courses that are going to be on offer by the Djibouti University? Has there been an expansion or perhaps a contraction of that original vision the government presented to the people of Djibouti when it made the announcement for the first time?
This is going to be a process that will evolve and will develop over time. And as we do that, then clearly new things will be added. So, yes, of course, there have been new things that there is a lot of work which has been done, but the core structure which we manage, we know to say, core faculties, health and research science, tourism and hospitality, business, and life and expenses. Those core faculties remain as they were when we announced. What the library is planning on for precisely the future that faculties will be doing. And in addition, we will, of course, come up with Institute of Professional Development and Continuing Education as announced. And also as announced, we will have a language center. What we're doing is developing specifically the areas which we're going to be in a position to announce very soon. And that's the Institute of Professional Development as indicated earlier in the question.
Mr. Speaker, and I know this will relate to question 51. Students obviously will be applying outside of the UK system. There will be a separate system set up, and that our students will be able to apply and therefore enroll for September.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, we will be able to maybe to answer another question in the order paper, but students will be applying directly to the university.
Question number 15, the Honourable Mrs. Alan Rosemary.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Education say which recognised body will be awarding degrees at the new University of Djibouti?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Education and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, programmes at the University of Djibouti will include degrees awarded by the University of London, the University of Business and Computing, and the University of Princeton in Georgia, the University of Medicine and Paramedic Science. In addition, the third place graduate students will be engaged in programs carried out in conjunction with other universities, depending on the various specialisms that are followed by those students.
Question number 51, the Honourable Mrs. Alan Rosen.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Education say whether undergraduate applications to the University of Djibouti will be managed by UCAS, which is the Universities and Colleges Admission Services?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Education and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, applications to the University of Djibouti will not be managed by UCAS. And do, however, envisage that in due course discussions will take place with UCAS on the possibility of applications being made.
Mr. Speaker, can the Honourable Minister say how will it be determined on who will be able to entitled to apply to the university and who will be setting the entry criteria and requirements, if not UCAS?
Well, Mr. Speaker, UCAS does not set out any entry criteria requirements for any university. The university can say set out entry criteria or register status to set the application and then submit those applications to the university for a response. So that element of somebody receiving the application and submitting it to the university director will not happen. But in relation to degree programs which we are doing in conjunction with other universities, for example, University of London program dedicated to students with fellows, and the University of London with the Hygienism Criterion, the same way as the University of Princeton. We are, as I have earlier mentioned, developing collaborations with other universities, which we already know and announced in relation to Shakers. I have today intended to speak specifically on that, and we'll be looking especially in relation to further collaborative projects with other universities. So as we develop these collaborations, we will certainly have to discuss with those other universities that we partner with the entrance requirements and criteria for those particular courses.
Question number 62, the Honourable Mr. Alan O'Hanlon.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Education advise where the lecturers for the University of Wales will be recruited from, what research will they be conducting, and where will funding for faculty research be coming from?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Education and Justice. Mr. Speaker, the intention is to recruit locally, but if required skills are not available, these will be sourced externally. Most of the research will be based within the Faculty of Life and Earth Sciences, which is also medical studies. However, there will be opportunities for research stemming from any of the other faculties. Research will be funded by the present funding schemes provided by the Department of Education, as well as the university's own funds. It is expected that there will also be some funding from private sector policies.
Would it be possible to allow any industry and companies to invest in research to fund facilities, perhaps related to marine or the environment? Or will it be totally state funded and can it allow for the flexibility for private and state funding?
People are gathering with this especially right from anybody who wants to come and fund the university to do so. As I have said in the last part of the answer, it is expected that there will be some funding to the private sector sponsorship. And we are already in discussion with elements of the private sector, specifically on that area.
Question number 63. I believe that a recent draft interesting from those different countries within EU funding to go towards the education of the forward. Can you confirm that these exploring ways to see some could be applicable and therefore could also be some way to beneficiary of such a thing that could be actually seen in all those? Yes, Mr. Speaker, this is certainly something that we are exploring and have been advised in relation to. The Erasmus student involvement extent of students is also involved certain universities being approved for that scheme. And given that we are in the process of establishing that university, it is impossible to receive that approval yet. But that is certainly a process that we will want to follow because we will want to be part of the European process in terms of funding this is wonderful for the Erasmus exchange of students and also continue to fund at the European level, which will be available to research.
Mr. Speaker, one final supplementary. The Honourable Minister mentioned the Institute of Professional Development and Continuing Education, the FNCCG, and professional qualifications for both private and public sectors. Now, my understanding that this is a role that at present the College of Higher Education has been offering through EV classes and the use of Greek House. As well. Does this mean that the remit of the college will be reviewed alongside the evolution and development of universities?
The structure of the remit will be reviewed, but certainly the ability and fact of hand to be collaborating with the university, and particularly with the institute. As the Honourable Lady said, some of the areas that the institute will be embarked upon are already being done through the college, and those will be done through the university by engaging with the college and passing upon their expertise and getting their involvement fully in the process. But it will not be limited, the institute will not be limited solely to the work that has been done in Charity Advisory College, which is an empowerment program, locally developed programs, in particular, short courses developed with industry associations. And I've given some examples of possibilities there for human resource management and compliance, and my role in this is with the association compliance officers, on insurance with the association. By working in conjunction with the private sector, by working with employers who we expect will be able to provide their benefits to these courses, and will be able to provide an element of day relief, whenever the day or the half day that they are accepting the engagement, so that the student can further his career or her career within that organization or elsewhere. So there will be a range of programs developed within the institute, and I think it's that one of the exciting parts of the university, as of course, from all the other parts of the university.
Question number 63, the Honourable E.J. Hayes. Yes.
If I think that further on to the answer provided to question number 1768. Of 2014. Can the Minister of Education now provide the missing details in respect to the number of students working down the agenda who are receiving subjects pertaining to GCSE examinations, which they have spoken in the academic year 2013-2014, and can be enrolled at the Gibraltar College of Further Education?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Education and Justice.
The number of students working down by gender who are refusing subjects pertaining to GCSE examinations which they sat for during the academic year 2013-2014 and are currently enrolled at the Gibraltar College of Further Education is 40 boys and 60 girls.
Question number 54, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
Can the Minister of Education provide details on how many supply teachers or supply auxiliary staff are currently engaged by the Department of Education, indicating at what educational establishments they are based, together with the reasons why their employment is necessary and estimated temporary teachers?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Education and Justice.
The information requested by the Honourable Member is sent out in the schedule of the Member's Manifestation. Towards the, or the very end of the first page, there's one college that the region for cover has been left in blank, followed by principal teachers, also the college, to meet optimum class size, etc. And then below that, there's no educational establishment. Then identified with lower. They all seem to be not just less than 3 months. So, after this, you know, mainly tend to be of a medical nature and so on. But the decision is having been just a minute. I have that one in respect to the college 3 months before that. Can you bring some light on this? Yes, Mr. Speaker. The one where it has been left blank, that is one which I didn't pick out, so I don't have specific information on the one entry which is blank. I could assume that studies related to nuclear cooling, class sizes and infrastructure, but I don't want to give that as a definitive answer. And I will therefore check the information, and I apologize that I actually couldn't pick up that there was one item where one column was left blank. The bottom part simply relates to 12 additional, apart from the supply people which are set out above as a cost. A total of 12 additional 12 people that are not on a fixed contract and simply have a certain access whenever and wherever they might be required. I'm not sure that the honourable member wants a list of so and so spent 3 days in district, so and so spent 2 days in Bayside. My understanding is that that relates to the server, the rest of the pool of supply people that do cover as and when required and not on a fixed contract. And the honourable member will remember that when we overhauled the system of supply work, including by employing those that we consider to have been in permanent supply, and those were part of the intake of 47 new people that we did at the beginning of our term of office. We also added the additional benefit that whenever supply people was engaged was needed for at least a month, that supply people would be given a fixed contract with all the necessary benefits that an employment contract will. So these are the, whenever there is an ad hoc need for a particular piece of paper or need, or someone is extra for the pool, those pieces are taken from the pool, or these additional pieces, it's not a fixed contract because it's on an ad hoc basis, and they are certainly for less than 2 months, because if it is beyond 3 months, then that is when the fixed contract is in, as we said that we were doing the beginning of our term of office. comment in the remarks column is in the case of being recruited. So my understanding is that these are posts of part-time cleaners that are available, and the cleaners for those posts are in the process of being recruited. On a supply basis or on a permanent and flexible basis? You think I'd be happy to double check that and tell the honourable member what my understanding is, that these are positions close to starting the season, and that's where they will be offered the job as part-time cleaners, not the supply, not simply going on a supply list, but actually engaged as part-time cleaners. That is my understanding, but I'd be happy to double check. Yes, and because we were I understand all that I'm saying, but being reported to become part-time cleaners, but, you know, will they be on a supply basis, for example, on a one-month contract or something, or will they be, you know, on an indefinite type of contract? I don't know if you want to really understand what they're going to try to get at. There may be some kind of. The second one there, the half explanation will help to understand it and try to get it. The back expert works for 18.75 hours a week. Certainly, people require an expert. As long as it's certainly people require an expert, many programs are appropriate. Once that child leaves with the business system, that post will not be required. So one understands why it is a supply basis. When it comes to the part-time cleaner, you know, will they be employed, you know, until they are eventually retirement, or is it just to cover a very short period of time? And it's difficult. The position, as I understand it, and if I am wrong in this, but I will let the honourable member know, but my understanding when I asked about this is that these are positions that are currently being filled, because the question relates to supply workers in the education department, where it's learning support assistants, teachers, cleaners. So this is a list of supply workers. Therefore, these positions, which currently exist, are being filled currently by supply workers, but the post exists as are in the process of being recruited. So whilst the recruitment is ongoing, and until the recruitment for the position ends, they are being filled by supply workers. Is the honourable member with me? I think there is a secret. It doesn't make sense really that it's typical of a benefit system. So, for example, at the moment, there is an assistant undefined person who is on a supply contract, but they're becoming already in the process of recruiting one that will become permanent. So, then, with the secret family, and we shed some light on the senior technician who was at the Water College employed for 17 hours a week, but then just seconded out to the USA. I mean, what means that the college has, that we have to be from the college to the college to the USA, or that one may have, and again, a bit less than I need pointing the head of it. This is someone who was engaged as a senior technician at the college, and is now currently seconded to the Jewish Football Association and works for the Jewish Football Association. We are looking at what precisely we do, because we have a person employed in that position, but the person is not physically there as a colleague, because he's actually working with us, and I know who the person is. He's actually working with the GFA, because the government agreed to second him to the GFA for that particular position that we request. So, for secondment, rather than a resignation and an engagement by the GFA, and the government agreed. But now we need to clearly, as something we need to regularize the position, and we need to fulfill that position. So, the position is, again, I go back to the table, is a supply worker. So, we have supply workers, my interpretation of the table is that we have to find workers filling these positions. They must have a reason why these positions are being filled. In some cases, because the telephone and the person have been recruited. In another one, because there is an additional need for a particular purpose at a particular time. And this one, because the officer that was doing that particular job has been seconded as well, and therefore there is a need for a supply worker to fill that position and to do that work. What we cannot do is recruit for that position because there's somebody who holds that position already or be seconded somewhere else. So in the meantime, while that person is seconded, we have to fill that position with a supply worker. We have to see the rest of the page to clarify this page substantially. However, in my understanding is that the senior position is now becoming to be a day, and it may be a separate question that requires separate notice. And the comment is still being faced by the college or the DSA system that says it's an interest now done. The current for that senior position is only for 17 hours a week. That is way, way less of what the senior position needs to work at the college. Does he have, you know, some of an idea of why we really need for 17 hours? Either the other fellow was for this underutilized or there has to be some other solution. It is not a life for life replacement from the force of officers to someone being replaced for only 17 hours in the week. 17 hours in the week just about covers 3 days a week of actual school teaching time. I don't have a specific answer to that. It may be that the rest of the time that the senior position used to do in the college is being covered in another way, which existed back at the college. It may be that that is the position. But what this table reflects is that we have a supply teacher covering this position for 70 hours a week, which is what the honorable member has said. If the honorable member says, well, why only 17 hours and what happens to the other? The rest of the time that the senior professor who has been seconded would have been working in the college and that is the semester that I don't currently have at this point. I mean, if I may, because I think it's a good question, then it's that happens in all the time where the senior position is seconded to DSA, is he still being paid in salary from the college as a choice of seconding to DSA, or is the DSA sitting in the and therefore that money is not being paid out in that salary, and that's the college making a savings in salary. I don't know for sure because I wasn't involved in that specific arrangement. I cannot only assume that it's a confirmation that the person is actually being paid by the DSA, and actually working at the DSA, and therefore I would expect that the DSA would be paying for that.
Question number 55, the Honourable Secretary Nettles.
If it is the Common Minister for Justice, his application is for summons to the state fishermen who allegedly contravene the Minister Protection Act due to raising of the seafloor on Boxing Day, the property of Chaplain Day, has now taken place, and it shows this indicates in such summons will apply to one justice or to the fish.
I'm for the Honourable Minister for Education and Justice.
I think I'm informed by the Royal Police that they have not yet made information before the Magistrate's Court for summons to be issued in respect to the time. Take a moment before we move on to any other items. Nevertheless, I think we all cordially agreed this morning that the Minister for the Sport and Health there were plenty to try and look at on the side. And I'm sure that if we had it, then it's rested in the rest of the hamster. And also, as well as my people, the feedback, I would have the minister, the new minister, how you have the sense of sort of reconfirming that what the report is going to be the same distribution of the independence that they were out. And if you have a feedback from the ministry that they were actually to come without, or if it's been like 100% taken by them, is there anything to say from it? Is that very, and then if you have any follow-up, I can give you an email for that.
If you could, in relation to the question that was addressed to me, I did ask, and the answer was, of course, we're giving to me, but I would rather wait because the information might be more confusing and might be more confusing to the other member, and therefore would like to clear with the staff, which I have not time to have to go through. But I can rest assured that I will be sending in a list with that information, most probably for the next session.
Order of the day. Bill, first and second reading. 1. A bill for an act to amend the Public Services Ombudsman Act 1998 and related matters. The Honourable Minister for Health, the Environment, Energy and Climate Change.
Speaker, before I move that the bill be read, let me just explain that although this is a bill for an act to amend the Public Services Ombudsman Act, and I am not the minister responsible for the ombudsman, in discussion with my colleagues, because this bill pertains exclusively to matters relating to complaints against the devotion of authority, I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to amend the Public Services Ombudsman Act 1998 and related matters be read the first time.
I now put the question, which is whether a bill for an act to amend the Public Services Ombudsman Act 1998 and related matters to avoid the first time. Those in favour? Those opposed? Carried. The Public Services Ombudsman Amendment Act 2014.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the bill now be read a second time. Mr. Speaker, the bill amends the Public Service Ombudsman Act 1998, so as to set out in the government's manifesto, part of responsibility for investigation of complaints against the devotion of authority for non-administrative matters from the DHA and the panel constituted under the devotion of authority complaints review panel Act 2004 to the Public Service Ombudsman. The bill provides for this transfer by amending the definition of an action which may be investigated by the ombudsman to include complaints against the devotion of authority, allowing the ombudsman to specify certain members of his staff to be tasked specifically with investigating complaints against the devotion of authority, creating a power for the Public Service Ombudsman to appoint one or more clinical assessors who must be external to the devotion of authority, so as to advise him in relation to complaints against the devotion of authority, setting out the circumstances where the ombudsman may obtain medical records in addition to the powers already in the act, and deeming that the prisoner has made a complaint, has waived the whole right to confidentiality against his Wilderness Authority with respect to the passing of the records and information to the public service ombudsman. On receiving the Devoted Health Authority complaint to the UTR Act 2004 and making conditional provision for outstanding matters. I commend this bill to the House.
Before I put the question, does any honourable member wish to speak on the termination of the merits of the bill?
Mr. Speaker, the opposition will be voting in favour of this bill. We are satisfied that the ombudsman and staff who have now set up a health jurisdiction for Gibraltar will continue to discharge their statutory duties in a special, impartial and thorough manner. The track record of this independent public service is evidence for no complaints and disputes are arbitrated successfully to the satisfaction of all involved. However, the opposition would like to learn in more detail how written or DHA formal complaints will be processed in practical terms and whether regular reports will still be submitted to the DHA board for scrutiny on the range of complaints made, whether they have been upheld or not, and what has been learned or improved as a consequence of the complaints. Will the public services ombudsman, with its clinical assessors, as the Honourable Minister has mentioned, will these clinical assessors have a presence in the DHA, an office where service users can submit a written complaint and fill in the required paperwork, or will they need to attend the ombudsman's office in person to do so? We hope the process will not be overly cumbersome for the members of the public that might feel reluctant to access the service. Now, if the service user is dissatisfied with the outcome of the written or formal complaint, can the Honourable Minister explain if the Ombudsman will provide another sphere of appeal via a higher authority such as an independent panel, and how this appeals process will be different to that of the present DHA independent complaints review panel? And obviously we understand that this is, of course, was the main reason for the government's manifesto commitment for the Ombudsman to adopt the DHA complaint procedure. Now, while the opposition requires some clarification from the Honourable Minister, Mr. Speaker, is in relation to dealing with verbal or what are known as the DHA informal complaint, and the provision also of a patient advisory service, which at present is so adeptly or has been so adeptly provided by the DHA complaint coordination team. With regard to these informal complaints, will the same process continue where a verbal complaint is made to the senior staff member of the department where the complaint originated? Or will the Ombudsman's office provide permanent personnel in the form of clinical assessors at the DHA to deal with and arbitrate this perhaps less serious complaint? Can the Minister advise who will process these recorded informal complaints so the information can be reported to the DHA board? And can the Honourable Minister advise as the continuation of successful patient advisory service, where up till now the DHA complaints being troubleshoot by assisting users who do not wish to complain but need help, information or advice in DHA services? Will some members of the DHA complaints team continue with this role, or will they be transferred as new employees of the Public Services Ombudsman Office? Or will this role just move to another department of the DHA, for example, the reception area of St. Bernard's Hospital? Or indeed, will the service be discontinued completely? All members of our community hope that the new Ombudsman DHA complaint service will, and I quote from Health Matters 2012-2014 here, provide a mechanism for users to report their grievances if they are dissatisfied with the services, to provide a way for the DHA as an organisation to listen to users, to create an understanding of patients' negative experiences and identify poor practice and gaps in service, and to identify any poorly performing service or department so that the DHA can improve its standards of care and service in that area. Mr. Speaker, we are confident the public services ombudsman can deliver on this, which is why the side of the House will be voting in favour of the bill. However, reassurance from the Honourable Minister as to the provision of a complete service, i.e. to include a patient advisory service, informal and formal complaints of the patient, and an appeals process would be desirable.
Before I call upon the Minister to reply, does anyone else have any other member wish to contribute to this debate? Call upon the Minister to reply, and then to put in the circle point.
Mr. Speaker, I would like to thank the Honourable Lady for those comments, and I want to reassure her, and I think I cover all the points that she has raised, that we will continue with a complete service, and I would like to think more complete than it needs to be. And the aim is certainly to improve the service that users can access. If I start for one point right away, and that is to confirm that clearly the new procedures will be reported on a regular basis to the board, and the board will review them. And I know the Honourable Lady knows, as a former member of the board, and the board will review them regularly at its meetings. The Ombudsman will be providing a complaint handling scheme, and I believe that the members of staff and behind them that have already been recruited, who will be based within the DHA. And they will have an office there and will be accessible directly to the public and will be able to provide, together with the support of the unit managers and the clinical staff, and indeed my own office staff, a very wide patient advisory service to a reference conference. Clarify queries which often avoid the need for complaints to be carried out in a more formal manner. The very basic complaints will, as now, be dealt with in the first instance by the members of staff themselves, and very often minor complaints can be cleared in at that level. If that doesn't work, or if the members of the public want to take that further, then the complaint handling scheme officers will carry out an investigation liaising with members of the DHA staff, but always answerable to the Ombudsman. The next level is that I'm unsatisfied. The complaint will be referred to one of the investigation officers at the Ombudsman's office, who will be the second level and try and determine the effect or the result of the complaint. And finally, if that is not satisfactory, then and this, of course, as I mentioned earlier, will allow the possibility of independent clinical assessments to come in and look at any clinical aspects that have to be reviewed. And the appeal will be to the Ombudsman himself, who will then set up the necessary investigation if there has to be a further level of investigation. So I think that we will have the benefit of additional members of staff from the Ombudsman's office working within St. Bernard's Hospital. Clearly, if a complaint on the other side, people will be requested to visit St. Bernard's Hospital, as is the case at the moment. And I believe that this produces a robust service, which I think will benefit the members of the public as a whole. I think, Mr. Speaker, that is covered for questions that the Honourable Member has raised, and therefore I commend the bill to them.
And now put the question, which is that the bill for an act to amend the Public Services Ombudsman Act 1998 and the legislature to vote a second time. Those in favour? Aye. Those against? Aye. The Public Services Ombudsman Act 2014.
The Speaker, I give to give notice to the committee today the third reading of the bill be taken today if all honourable members agree.
Honourable members agree that the committee stays from first reading of the bill be taken today. I understand that we are not proceeding today with the
secondary one from an into Parliament that as we do the best way with the government.
Can you just say the honourable speaking stuff?
But to figure out the honest move of the House to resolve itself into committee to consider the Public Services Ombudsman Amendment Bill 2014, clause by clause.
For an act to amend the Public Services Ombudsman Act 1998 and related matters. Clauses 1 to 2.
Clauses 1 to 2 stand part of the bill.
The long title stand part of the bill.
Mr. Chairman, the audit report of the Public Service Ombudsman Amendment Bill 2014 has been considered in committee and agreed to without amendment, and there are no rules that have been read for the third time in the past.
I now put the question, which is that the Public Service Ombudsman Amendment Bill 2014 be read the third time in the past. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
For the fourth, the beginning of the fourth consecutive year, it is my honor to move that the House will now adjourn to the deal to return next month to continue the process of monthly meeting.
I now propose the question, which is the House will now adjourn to the deal. I now put the question, which is that this House will now adjourn to the deal. Those in favor? Those against? Carried. I have to know the end of the year.